You're listening to the Mythgreen Podcast with your hosts, Oren Ashkenazi, Wes Matlock, and Chris Winkle. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. Cause she never wore socks, she had a pet snake, she bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do, so she did what she wanted to. Everybody knew the story of the princess who saved herself.
This episode was produced thanks to our patron, Kathy Ferguson, professor of political theory in Star Trek.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mythgreens Podcast. I'm your host, Wes, and with me today is...
Oren.
And...
Chris.
And today we're talking about the classifications, the many, many, many classifications of magic, from stories to role-playing games to video games. We're here to add to the confusion. So guys,
we will definitely cover every single magic system and how it's divided in the next 30
definitely.
Minutes. That will definitely
yes.
happen.
In putting this together, it all became clear. I know nothing about any of this. There's just so many different types. But I was thinking maybe just to start, I think maybe addressing how like broad category or the type of broad categories that there are first before we start getting into the nittier grittier ones. Mm-hmm. So the first thing that kind of came to mind for me is that most magic systems and stories, games, etc., there's always some kind of elemental magic, which at the most basic level, there's earth magic, air magic, water magic, fire magic.
Yes, although in a lot of systems that would all be classified as like evocation or something.
True.
Because you know, like not every system, you know, really goes by an elemental split.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. some magic systems, depending on how limited the effects are, they may not affect elements at all. But it is very common, though. It is surprisingly
yeah.
common
mm-hmm.
because when you think of get right down to it, elements are actually pretty arbitrary. They're like an entirely cultural thing.
Aristotle's behind it all.
Aristotle.
It's all his fault. Ever since Aristotle, we've been obsessed with this idea of fire, water, earth, and mm-hmm. air. I mean, like, and I mean, like, admittedly, that is very thematic and like, you know, it makes sense at first where it's like, yeah, okay, dirt, water, air, and fire are all very distinct things. And then you get into weird questions like, how does wood fit into
mm-hmm.
that? And you know, I think Aristotle would say that wood is like a combination of all of them because it's got fire in it when it burns and then it releases the air, which is the smoke. And then, I don't know, whatever. Aristotle's behind it all is the point.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah, that not a lot of schools do that, but a lot of, I feel like if there are any kind of basic elements that then derive things from them, there's often some kind of elemental connection, especially if you extend what might be, like, considered elemental to include things like life, death, chaos, order, positive, negative, right? Like,
yeah, for instance, mage has entropy. Mage has entropy as an element. Like, it's mm-hmm. basically an elemental system, but with that extended, right?
Yeah.
Right. Well, it was actually funny to me that in, you always forget this in Mage. Entropy is supposed to cover death, but, like, everyone always forgets that, which is why in the next edition they separated it into fate and death and made death its own thing.
Mm-hmm. Fate is an element. And, okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
fate magic.
Fate is a very useful element for the GM because when the GM gets you into a situation that he's not sure how to get you out of, and someone has fate magic, just be like, "Yeah, roll fate magic." I guess a truck drives by and you get on it or something. You know, whatever.
Summon truck.
Summon a coincidence.
Because like the way fate. Yeah. Because, like, fate magic does actually have specific rules in Mage, but most games that I've played in, anyway, end up using it just as the roll to make a coincidence happen magic.
Mm-hmm.
And it does do other things, but that's, like, the most interesting and the one that everyone remembers.
Yeah. But, yeah, I think as Wes was saying, it is a little strange, the number of systems that have elemental magic in them, because in a way, again, it's just very cultural. It's almost arbitrary in its way.
Mm-hmm. It is. And I mean, just saying that it's arbitrary, that's something that I was thinking about. Like, I mean, we will get into like the names of the different types of schools, but I got this impression, and I'm curious what you two think about this, mm-hmm. that if you just say these are the, you know, schools of magic, or these are like the colleges of study or whatever, it's kind of, it's arbitrary, right? Like, it's mm-hmm. just like, you know, these people do conjuration and these people do divination, and those are separate schools. But if you have like a more, if like you have a strong elemental presence, maybe that's trying to like persuade people that there is like rationale to an otherwise completely arbitrary okay. like system of magic.
All right, all right, all right. I'm going to hit you with some truth.
Yes,
here, okay?
I love truth hits. The truth should be your form of magic, Oren.
I cast truth magic. Okay, no, the truth is that all magic is equally arbitrary because magic's not real.
Oh, no. Why would you burst that bubble?
I know, right? The difference, the key is making it feel like it's not arbitrary. And that's where divisions like earth, fire, water, and air come into it, because they feel right. Mm-hmm. Dividing magic into those things, because those feel different and they have properties, and it's like, okay, you can imagine that an airbender could, for example, use sound as part of their bending, because sound is like a property of air. And you can imagine that a firebender could use lightning, because lightning is, you know, fire-like in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Water and healing is a little bit weirder, because water is often associated with health, so like I think that's why people generally buy it. Mm-hmm. But then compare that to something like Mistborn, where I get a lot of complaints about Mistborn, people saying that the magic feels arbitrary and like an artificial, and I'm like sitting here like, why do people say that? Because all magic is arbitrary and artificial. And then I was like, oh, it's because nothing in Mistborn has any thematic weight to it. It's like, okay, in Mistborn you get magic from consuming different types of metal, but like, you know, pewter gives you super strength for some reason. It's like, why pewter? Why does pewter give you super strength? And like, you know, steel lets you push things away really fast, and it's like, why that? Why does that? What's the copper, I think, lets you hide your presence from other magic users, and it's like, those, what do those metals have in, like, it connects them to the powers that they give in mm-hmm. any way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference between something that feels arbitrary versus something that feels like it has a logical setup mm-hmm. to it.
And I will say that elemental systems in general tend to work well and feel really rational if you limit the magic somewhat, right? Because, like, for instance, if you have Avatar, you know, like Last Airbender and Korra, that system, you know, what people can do is not anything under the sun. It's, you specifically can control and manipulate or manifest one type of substance or one type of element, right?
Mm-hmm.
But elemental systems do tend to break down and start to feel arbitrary when you go beyond that. Like, if you want magic workers to be able to just do anything with their magic, but you're still trying to make it elemental, then you start to get into weird things where, like, well, let's see, I want them to do this spell, but like, there's no element that it seems to fit in intuitively. And then you start like stretching and making weird associations between elements and like spell effects that just don't feel intuitive. And then it starts to feel arbitrary again.
Hmm.
Right. And we've hit on the big reason, or at least I think the most important reason in fiction, why you even bother to divide your magic into these classifications. And I think the most important reason is that it gives the audience a way to sort of predict what new abilities a character will have, or if not predict, at least like feel a common association, right? Where it, like in Avatar, because we always use Avatar because it's a great example, most of the time in Avatar, when a character demonstrates a new power, it like feels like a natural extension of a power they already have, because we have this classification system,
right?
And there are some exceptions, like the the bloodbending that can do everything in Korra, for example, is one. But most of the time, they're pretty good about it. They have these categories, and they're like, these categories are memorable and they are simple, and so that when they demonstrate a new power, everyone's like, yeah, that makes sense. I can absolutely believe that a waterbender could bend somebody's blood and like meat puppet them, And it just seems natural. And nobody asks, like, well, why doesn't the waterbender just, like, use the water in their veins to crush their heart? Why do they not do that? And the answer is, God, what's wrong with you? But like, nobody is asking that question because it feels like it makes sense, right? It's not like a waterbender is suddenly shooting fire out of their hands and you're like, hey, hang on a minute. and so, like, that's, I think, the most important reason to break magic into categories. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of systems can, like, feel arbitrary and weird. Like, in Mage, for example, Mage has, like, 9 different, like, elements, as it were. They're called spheres, or, like, 10 if you go to the next edition. And a lot of them feel are a little bit like, it's sometimes hard to tell, like, is creating fire a forces effect or a prime effect? Which one? There's a lot of overlap, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And it's, like, Mage isn't too bad, but it does have that problem.
I mean, I personally wouldn't say it's necessarily the categories themselves so much as the fact that if you have a magic system that you want to do a lot of things, breaking into categories makes it easier to conceptualize and makes it feel smaller, right? So if you have some magic systems that are, like, very limited in their scope, that somebody, you know, all magic users in this world can do is make plants grow. That's, like, their only magic ability, right? You can get from a sense all of the things that they could do with that ability. But when you have a magic system that's much larger and it's supposed to produce a really variety of effects, suddenly it becomes much harder to conceptualize all of the things that they're supposed to be doing. And then I think breaking it into categories just makes it feel smaller. If you're not putting those, if you don't want to put on too many limits, right? Which mm-hmm. in a lot of, I mm-hmm. think a lot of systems, limits are beneficial because they let you more easily think about the implications of what people are casting and make sure there's not plot holes and stuff. But if you're not going to, kind of, it's almost like the elements are like sublimits. Limits for part people.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, we use the classifications the same way that we would use, like, a bullet list, mm-hmm. right? Instead of putting everything in a giant paragraph, it's like, okay, we have this list of, instead of the giant paragraph of magic, we have a list of bullet points, and, like, one bullet point is evocation and one bullet point is illusion, etc. Mm-hmm. Right? Because you have a little bit of, like, you feel like there's some system going on behind it. Whereas, like, sometimes I don't, like, honestly, I think that if you just took the schools of magic out of D&D, for example, because D&D has, like, abjuration, conjuration, divination, etc., etc., I think if you just took those out, I think most people wouldn't notice.
I'll offer a point of contention on that.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that if everyone were if sorcerer were the only, like, arcane casting class, that would be fine. But the way they present the wizard class is such that having these, like, having, like you said, abjuration, conjuration, divination, having these, like, schools that are, like, highly specialized is, like, in a way mirroring, like, the rigorous, like, academic process, right? Where, like, you know, if you're a conjurationist, then you got your, you went and studied hard and got your PhD in conjuration, right? And you had to cut all the divination classes to make time for, like, you know, summoning super awesome monsters. And so that's why you can't cast a basic identify spell, right? Like, mm-hmm. you just had to skip that in order to get your credentials. But the reason mm-hmm. why I think that still has value on, like, D&D is if you want, as, like, a GM to, like, embrace more of, like, a, you have more opportunities there to, like, have, why are the wizards in this town researching this specific thing, right? Why do they all consider themselves abjurationists? And, you know, learning what that is and what it does could unearth a larger plot point. I mean, I kind of think if you take it from, like, more of a research and academic focus, then most research and academics is highly specialized. And so in a way that makes sense. But if everybody just had natural magic that just they were born with, then schools don't make any sense. Right. Mm-hmm. Or if everybody was a divine caster, then schools don't make any sense because right. they're not learning about it. They're just doing it.
I think that.
Right. Well,
I think that ties back into the magic school categories. Right. When we talk about magic schools, we almost expect magic to fall into, like, subjects, you know, and I think this is the big thing about Harry Potter, right? Harry Potter at Hogwarts,
the magic is categorized in a way that is almost designed to be like a traditional school system. Mm-hmm. And it is kind of arbitrary, but at the same time, so is school subjects. They're also pretty arbitrary, and they reflect a lot of different ways of categorizing things, including like, what is this used for, or, you know, who should use it, or what kind of effects we're creating, you know, and it's true. I think that the issue with the D&D, of course, is that, you know, having disciplines makes sense, but the disciplines themselves are just probably like really easy to forget, because they're just like, what does that even mean? It's not intuitive.
And also it requires you to like deal with like weird crossovers, right? Like necromancy is the school that harms and heals bodies, right? And so like, if you're a student of necromancy, it's like, you know how to cast healing spells potentially, but you also can create and summon undead, which the book says that is specifically quite an evil thing to do. So it's like, our school will teach you how to do this, but don't you do that, because then you'll be super evil, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, yeah. it's the same thing with the conjuration school, because they also have the teleportation spell. So I'm like, okay, so are you like conjuring some kind of like rift in time? Is that what you're doing? Like,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is, I think we kind of hit on an interesting distinction here, which is what I would call the distinction between descriptive magic classifications and prescriptive magic classifications. And I'm not sure one is better than the other necessarily, but a descriptive magic classification is something where it feels like, okay, so humans found that magic is a thing, and they realized that like they needed to divide it into classifications, if for no other reason so that they would know which class to send students to. Mm-hmm. And you certainly get the feeling that in Harry Potter, like charms class could be called something else in another school, or even be taught very differently, because charm seems to be everything that's not one of the other types of magic. right? And like, I would argue that the Harry Potter classification is a little bit too loosey-goosey even for a descriptive one, but it's still like, there's the feeling that like, we have these classifications that are not perfect because humans made them, the same way that like our species classifications are not perfect, right? Mm-hmm. Where like we're discovering new things that are like, that call into question, like, is this species actually a species, and should we change it, or should we just keep calling it one because everyone's used to it being a species? Mm-hmm. Right? That's that sort of thing. Versus prescriptive, which is when where these are clearly classifications that like exist within the world, and like anybody could tell. And again, that's back to the water, fire, earth, air thing. Mm-hmm. Where it's like or mage is prescriptive too, even though there's a little bit of blurriness in there, which is one of the reasons why mage is really hard to use for a magic school game, because it's like, in mage, sending a mage who only has ranks in forces to a life magic class would be pointless. Like that mage just cannot cast life magic. They just can't do it because they are prescriptive classifications. Whereas the magic school like default that we all use, because everyone has read Harry Potter now, assumes a descriptive system, which is why D&D actually works better for a magic school by default than mage does. And I'm sorry, I just praised D&D. Lords of indie RPGs, please forgive me. But I did.
I'm gonna segment that and just keep it on repeat. Anytime you are out against it, I'm gonna be like, well, Arne, and then play the tape back.
let's remember this one time you said something,
Arne. So while we're talking about schools and classifications, I guess, for lack of a better word, maybe like, they're like artificial magics in the sense of like, an artificer must like make them, and they're tangible. So three that come to mind are magic school of enchanting, right? Like, and alchemy and or potions, whatever you might want to loop those into. Mm-hmm. And whether or not like those are the same types of schools of magic, I think is something that's a little bit up in the air to me. I like the idea that, you know, an enchanter, like in the sense of making enchanted stuff, might not be able to cast like magic missile, right? But knows how to like weave like magic into things instead. Mm-hmm. And I also kind of like the idea that like an alchemist, like, I guess I think about Harry Potter, right? I guess that they need to use their like wands to like make sure that the potions work. But I kind of like the idea that like there's just like a science to creating something with a magical effect in terms of like a potion, right? Like, can a human make a Polyjuice potion if they have all the right things?
Yes.
wait, no, I mean, like, can Muggles make Polyjuice potion? Could Muggles make magical?
Yes, yeah. they absolutely
they can.
Can.
Is that happen in the story?
No, but there is literally no reason they can't. Like, I have looked as far as I can tell from reading the books, I'm like we're like halfway through book five at this point for our reread. I have not found anything to suggest a Muggle could not make a Polyjuice potion. Like, as far as I can tell, they basically don't use their wands for anything that you couldn't do with your hands. Like, at one point, I think someone uses their wand to stir the potion. And it's like, you could stir that with a spoon, man.
Right.
But Orin, maybe like, it's old magic.
Uh-oh.
Maybe there's like an old magical compact between like wizards and their cauldrons. I
wouldn't put it past J.K. Rowling, master of the retcon, to say in an interview somewhere that Muggles can't make potions. But like, if I, looking at Harry Potter, at the information provided, and this actually works with alchemy, the idea of alchemy as a whole, is that alchemy doesn't require any kind of inborn magical ability. It's just alchemy is basically a science. The only difference is that in the real world, it didn't work.
but here's the thing, though. This is the weird thing. If that's true, I feel like every time we meet a squib in the Harry Potter series, mm-hmm. they would be like a, you know, plant and potion specialist.
Yeah. Yeah, you may have discovered a small crack in the otherwise ironclad world building of Harry Potter.
I'm just saying, the books don't show them overtly, you know, using inherent wizard magic when they're doing potions. But at the same time, I would consider that question very non-clarified.
I'm going to do Harry Potter fan fiction about a squib who just does potions. I'm sure that already exists. I'm sure there are 50 million fanfics about that.
yeah, there's nothing stopping the squibs from just plugging their ears and going and harvesting mandrake roots, right? Like, just making stuff.
As far as we know. Oh, well, actually, maybe there is, because there was a question of whether squibs can see dementors. And whether, apparently, Muggles cannot see dementors, right? They cannot even, which, frankly, if that happens a lot, that would explain a lot in the Harry Potter world, if Muggles just can't see a lot of magical things or notice that they're there. Although, I think they do suggest that they, I feel like there's suggestion that there are magical things that wizards deliberately hide from them, but I'm not certain.
Yeah. Well, it's not a suggestion. It's they straight up say that a lot of magical things in Harry Potter have anti-Muggle charms that, like, yeah, at one point they even describe them. I think it's in the Quidditch World Cup where they're like, as a Muggle approaches this area, they will suddenly get a very strong urge that they left the oven on and that they need to go back and turn it off or something. And that's why, like, hikers don't accidentally hike through Hogwarts, right? Wherever the heck Hogwarts is actually supposed to be.
Right. But the thing is that, like, okay, so in book four, we have Miss Fig, who, like, is a witness that the Dementors attacked Harry. And she tells the court that squibs can see Dementors, but the actual way it's narrated suggests that she's lying. Because she can't describe the way that they look, only how they feel. Right?
Yeah, although, I mean, you could also describe that as her being very nervous for being in front of the literal wizard president, who is also a judge for some reason.
Separation of powers.
They don't have that. That's not a thing, you know. But anyway, I mean, you're right, Chris. That scene is kind of unclear, and it's certainly not impossible that you need to have some kind of inborn magic-iness in order for a potion you make to work. I can't say that's not true.
Yeah, all I'm saying is it's deeply unspecified in the books.
Yes.
Right. Magic schools are kind of an interesting beast of their own, but I can understand why D&D would be a good way to implement them.
Well, it just works a little bit better because, again, like, a wizard can learn spells from any of the schools of magic is what they're called in D&D, mm-hmm. right? And then like, but they can specialize in certain ones if they want to. So like, you could have a wizard go to conjuration class, even if they aren't like super good at conjuration spells. Mm-hmm. Now it's still not great, but it works better than mage. Mm-hmm. Is really the point I was driving at. Something else that I wanted to touch on for magic classifications is that I think that writers would do well to remember that if it's important for their story to divide magic from different sources, which a lot of stories do, those magics should actually be fundamentally different in some way. This is one of my beefs with, you know, D&D, basically, is that divine magic and arcane magic are exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Like, even though theoretically one of them comes from the gods. I had the same problem with mage. At one point, I made a character who was a celestial chorister who theoretically got her power from her god, but it felt like I was like every other mage because I just did a spell whenever I needed one, and I felt like I was constantly calling my god up, being like, God, I need a lightning bolt. God. God.
Yeah.
You know, like, if that would be kind of annoying,
I guess,
right?
D&D really does just, like, lay it out for you right there in the book, though. I think that there's a line where it says something like, magical scholars, like, say that application can differ, but all magic comes from, like, the same source. So that's probably why they basically have the same functions, right? Like, there's...
I think it's just too difficult to
mechanically make them different.
Yeah, good point.
I think that's just a huge task for an already ginormous system, right?
Yeah, and I mean, certainly if you make them different, that can cause problems. Like, in Burning Wheel, arcane magic and divine magic are very different. They function very differently. Unfortunately, one of the side effects of that is that divine magic is really overpowered in that system. Because there's really no reason not to just constantly do it, because there's no penalty for failure. But that's like a specific mechanical issue, mm-hmm. right?
I think,
and like, I was just gonna say, whenever you make things substantially different, especially in a role-playing game, but in regular fiction too, you open the possibility that those things will be abusable.
I do want to mention, I think this is related to the different sourcing. Some settings mm-hmm. basically have magic classifications where the magic is so different that it's practically a different magic system. Most often, they have completely different sets of people, right? And I think I would consider D&D to be kind of one of these, because we have sorcerers and wizards who have completely different ways of getting their magic and are different groups of people. And I mean, I guess theoretically you could have a sorcerer who, you know, multi-classes and is also a wizard, but that's kind of by coincidence, right? As opposed to something like Harry Potter, where everybody's a wizard and they have all these different, like, subject matters that they choose from. And even though potion making is, you know, an entire different methodology, it's usually the same people performing it.
Right. And I mean, like, it's weird, and D&D is particularly strange because it's like, theoretically, sorcerers and wizards are supposed to be very different, because a sorcerer is someone who just, like, has magic powers, and a wizard is, like, a nerd who studied magic books long enough that they, like, learned how to cast magic, and theoretically anyone can do that. And those two things, like, coexisting in the same system feel very strange, and they feel even stranger that they use exactly the same spells.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's right? just, like, how does... yeah, the sorcerer's different in the sense of, like, what type of... What do they call it? Like, meta magic, like, effects that they can apply to it.
Or I mean, they're mostly different in how they, like, prepare their spells, right? Like, they're mostly different in that wizards have to memorize their spells ahead of time, and sorcerers can just pick from all the spells that they know. Like, that's the real difference between sorcerers and wizards.
The real difference is who has to lug around a spell book, right?
Yes, exactly.
A source difference, and, you know, whether or not this is truly a source difference, please feel free to jump in. But I did like in, my only experience is with Dragon Age Origins, but I like that there's the, whatever they call it, the College of the Citadel or something like that. But the presence of blood magic, I thought, was actually done quite well, because the source was clearly different, right? Like, there was a question of, like, mm-hmm. willpower which like this the college has, and then blood magic seemed to be like something different from willpower. It's like actual like life force. To and the magic that you could cast through blood magic was very different from the magic that you cast from the other schools that they had in that game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, blood magic represents your sort of your classic temptation style magic, at least in the later games, because like in the later games it was like you found out that like mages, anytime a mage wants to, they can basically just like spill some blood and cast really powerful magic, but it like corrupts mm-hmm. them, which means that all mages at all times have this like dark temptation sitting like just outside their field of view, right? Which is a which is like important for the setting, right? It's sort of like the dark side of the force. Mm-hmm. It's not clear to me that they necessarily have different sources. But they maybe do. Like, the mythology of Dragon Age is very confusing to me. They're certainly different, though.
Yeah.
I would give them that.
I guess if I were going with something like that, I think it is nice if it feels in-world related in some way to a certain extent, just because that makes your system feel more rational.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can imagine with a system like that, if we've got, you know, mages who cast magic using some sort of will, but they can also spill blood, it feels a little bit like that maybe it comes from the same resource because it's still coming from people, right? Ultimately.
Yeah, good point.
But like by spilling blood, they're capitalizing it in a way, almost like extracting more magic than they mm-hmm. could otherwise. I know Mistborn, for all its faults and arbitrariness, also has three different kind of sources / systems, but they I think they feel more related than most. They've got the one where you just, like, digest little metal bits and like, burn it. And then they have people who actually wear metal and, like, store energy and harvest energy from that metal. And then they have... The last one is, like, hemallergy, where you use metal and, like, blood to, like, steal people's magic powers. And they're basically different ways of doing magic, but they're still kind of related to each other.
Yeah.
And they have and we haven't even talked about like that much about like light side, dark side. We're starting to get into it. Magic. But I think they fall on a spectrum of like order, balance, and chaos, I think. Which sort of fits into the overall plot of the Mistborn series.
Now, unfortunately, we are about out of time. So obviously there's way more magic stuff we could talk about. Like I said, we probably did not get to every magic system that has ever existed. So perhaps we will return to this topic again sometime. Until then, if anything we said piqued your interest, you can leave a comment on our website at mythcreants.com. Otherwise, we will talk to you next week.
Mischievous goblins, cheeky robots, twisted fairy tales, and an epic space battles. It's all in our new fiction podcast, Mythcreant Storytime. There was a castle by a waterfall with a pink and purple wall and a princess living there. She had no parents and was all alone. She got by on her own and she liked it pretty well. 'Cause she never wore socks. She had a pet snake. She bought a red guitar and she ate a whole cake. And there wasn't anybody there to tell her what to do.
This has been the Mythcreant Podcast. Opening closing theme, The Princess Who Saved Herself, by Jonathan Colton.